The following panel discussion was recorded live at the Cannabis Hemp Conference held July 9th and 10th, 2016 at the Vancouver Western Bayshore. This podcast is made possible by the Cannabis Growers of Canada, the InternetDispensary.com, and CannabisLifeNetwork.com.
Big, huge thanks to Salome. Oh my goodness, Salome, this has been so fantastic. I really think this was hugely successful. It's been just perfect on so many levels. So I'm going to get right into introducing the panelists, and then we'll just talk a little bit about kind of where we are. This panel is the current and future state of dispensaries panel. So I just want to introduce Andrea Dobbs, first of all. And I guess we should, I don't know, do we bring them up one by one? It's like Price is Right or something. Come on down. Come on down. As a holistic health enthusiast and career entrepreneur, Andrea focused her lens on the cannabis arena, buoyed by her successful integration of cannabis remedies to manage the various symptoms of perimenopause and a desire to share the success with others. Andrea's history includes progressive community businesses in food services, retail, and health. Now a passionate proponent of medical marijuana, Andrea is a co-founder of the Village Dispensary and a chairperson for Women's Grow Vancouver's chapter. Andrea? All right, who's next on the... And it's Andrew Gordon is next. Andrew, where are you out there? Come on down. Andrew's the COO and Community Integration Director of Cannawide Dispensaries in Vancouver and Toronto. Andrew currently works with Cannawide Dispensaries in Vancouver and Toronto, specializing in operational efficiency, patient relations, community partnerships, and CAMCD compliance. During 2015 and 2016, Andrew worked as a Community Integration Director for True Natural Healing Society, a nonprofit compassion club based in Kitsilano, dedicated to providing qualified patients access to natural cannabis solutions and holistic services. He's excited at the prospect of legalization and is passionate about working with key community stakeholders from across Canada to build an understanding and acceptance for cannabis to help reduce social stigma for consumers and abate pharmaceutical drug dependence within communities. Andrew? Awesome, thank you. Next on the list here is Juana Nakora, the CEO of Eggs Canada. Juana, come on down. Juana began her advocacy to have cannabis recognized as a viable form of treatment and pain management for patients undergoing chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and for dual modality patients during her time at the Fraser Valley Cancer Agency. Juana continues her fight for the use of medical marijuana as a form of treatment and preventative care of many widespread illnesses and ailments in her work today. She's now the CEO of three Eggs Canada locations, an ever-growing dispensary chain whose primary focus is on patient care and funding future cannabinoid research and applications. Juana is also on the dispensary board for the Cannabis Growers of Canada, a nonprofit organization whose goals include lobbying at all... Oh, and happy 420. Sorry about that. The alarm just went off there. Sorry to interrupt there, but... whose goals include lobbying at all levels of government, including federal, to ensure that all new laws and legislation are reflective of patients' rights for safe access, affordability, and fair treatment and recognition of the grassroots communities, including dispensaries and MMAR growers. So, Juana, thank you. And where is he next? David Malmalevine, come on down. David Malmalevine, a cannabis author and activist, and also founder of Stressed and Depressed Association, Vancouver here. David has been writing about cannabis since 1992 and organizing civil disobedience since 1993. In 1995, David was flown out from Edmonton to Vancouver to be a professional pot activist by Mark Emery. In 1996, David sold pot openly, creating the legend of Vansterdam. Charges from his harm reduction club led David to become the youngest self-represented person to appear before the Supreme Court. Since his defeat there, David created the Herb School and the Herb Museum. The former resulted in 4 months jail time, and the latter he sold to a U.S. pot activist in order to open up a med pot dispensary for both sick and healthy people, and that's Stressed and Depressed. His websites are potshot.ca, herbmuseum.ca, and stressedanddepressed.ca. All right, there we go. There's our panelists. So it's a strange time to be in the marijuana business here in Canada. On the one hand, we have a federal medical marijuana program beginning with the Parker Court decision in 2000 that's allowed some Canadians to access marijuana for medical purposes. And over the years, because the rules have been too restrictive, we've had further gains through the courts. We've also had some losses when it comes to regulations. For example, the conservative government recently banning the home growing of marijuana by patients. So we keep going kind of back and forth. But the system we have still remains too restrictive. Right now we have a small group of companies allowed to produce through a distribution model that is just through the mail, through home delivery. And we have the Allard case, which was recently in the courts, that looked at those conservatives' new rules about the home growing and basically threw the entire thing out as against the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, saying that the act of growing at home for patients is an important part. So it's kind of a weird system on the federal level. We also have Justin Trudeau, now elected, saying he's going to legalize marijuana for recreational purposes as well as for medical, but of course he's put a police officer named Bill Blair in charge and another politician named Ann McClellan, who over the years have been kind of against marijuana, prohibitionists, and they don't really seem like they're going in a, I mean, we haven't seen it yet, but there's some fears over the direction that they're going. 20 years ago, the first Compassion Club started popping up. And over the years, those shops have proliferated in places like Vancouver and Toronto and a bunch of other smaller communities. And the police in many of the jurisdictions refuse to bust those dispensaries and have allowed them to be there for 20 years. Some cops in certain jurisdictions have gone after them. And recently, we've had major raids in Toronto. There was 47 dispensaries raided. At the same time, we have municipalities making their own rules for marijuana dispensaries. Ones like in Vancouver that include $30,000 for a license, but also restricts over 90% of the current spots they were at. So we also have Victoria and other places coming up with their own legislation, making this sort of patchwork gray area for marijuana across the country. Everybody wants a piece of it as we go forward into legalization, and you have liquor stores and drug stores lobbying the government on a provincial level to allow them to be selling marijuana as we move forward. You also have the LPs, some of the LPs, lobbying to close these dispensaries and eliminate them completely. So that's kind of where we're at. It's a weird place to be. But here's the questions that we've kind of come up with here. How do we ensure that existing small businesses in the cannabis realm, all of our dispensaries that are there now, transition into the new cannabis marketplace? And I wanted to start with Andrea on that one.
Well, that is the million-dollar question. And I've taken a little time to consider that. For myself, I think there's two layers here, or two ways to go, or two factors to consider is what I mean. We could look to marketplaces that allowed continuity of business. So in Oregon, that was a business model they went with. They decided that those who met a series of best practices could integrate into the existing marketplace. So I'd like to see something like that at least studied. And the other piece, I think, is that we elected, many of us, not all of us, elected Justin Trudeau, and he had a mandate to support the middle class, and many small businesses are the middle class. And if he were to take this industry out of BC and hand it over to multinational-style corporations, that would be against his mandate, and I think that we could put some pressure on him from that point.
Thank you, Andrea. Yeah, those are all great points. You know, it's a tough question when you look at transition in general. It's volatile, it's uncertain, and as business owners, you look for a certain amount of metrics and certainty. But at the end of the day, you know, you start one person at a time. And what I try and do is really, it's not about just breeding customers or building your membership. It's about creating advocates, because when you have people out there in the community that are speaking on your behalf, are sharing the knowledge and the evidence-based research in cogent and considerate ways, the conversation changes. And when that happens, magic happens. And I see it every single day in the shops that I'm a part of and the wonderful people that I work with in this industry who are cultivating that same dynamic. And that brings me to my second point here, is staying attuned to opportunities to join forces with like-minded people, because that's going to increase positive momentum. And when you look for those opportunities, whether it's your vendor, it's your neighbor, it's a guy who made a complaint about you, there's opportunities there, and you can really connect and provide an opportunity for exchange that is accountable and transparent, and that's what people are looking for in this industry. It seems scary from the outside. It's unregulated, it's illegal. That's another factor we do address. And you have to be forthright about that. You have to be transparent. And people respond and make their own informed choices. And you really are there to facilitate a need that is great. So if you focus on those points, I think the transition will be easier and the integration will be welcome.
I agree. I think those are all great points. I think that we can all recognize that the government's really slow at doing anything. They're great that they've already started this legislation and that they're willing to legalize it. So I think that if the dispensaries want to solidify their place, we need to be the ones coming up with the legislation, and we need to be the ones writing the reform and bringing it to their attention. We need to stick together and unify. All the different trade memberships need to come together, and this is the time where we need to have our voices heard. In the communities, we know that we are a staple. People want us in the community. So I think what we need to do now is come together and bring that notion to the federal and provincial governments. We cannot wait for them to write legislation because it's not going to be in our favor. We need to be proactive, and we need to be doing it now.
Yeah, sure. David?
I'd like to echo that wisdom from my fellow panelists. I actually did write an example of possible legislation for the government to mull over, chew on. I think we have to recognize that we'll get whatever we insist on, just like industrial hemp. Government didn't want to legalize that. We insisted, and they relented. Same with medical marijuana, same with some kind of recreational marijuana. We'll get whatever we insist on, but we have to be united in a vision of what we want. And I think what we all want here is an inclusive economy where everyone who wants to smoke can smoke, everyone who wants to grow can grow, and everyone who wants to be a retailer can be one. So that will involve a lot of work on destigmatization, mostly around youth use. We have to be more realistic about cannabis's harms relative to other soft drugs like caffeine. We have to look honestly at the information about cannabis not actually causing any psychosis, increase in psychosis or decrease in IQs. And we have to be brave and stand up to all the ignorant parents in Canada and say, no, actually, it's not going to hurt your teen, and here's why.
So, yeah, David, we're going to have that as kind of an expanded question because I know that's one of the areas that is important to David. But there's been a lot of these groups coming out that are trade associations, lobby groups for different parts of the marijuana community. The LPs have theirs, and there's others. What are the first steps we need to take to really build a unified front, do you guys think? As members of the craft cannabis community, or whatever we want to call the dispensaries, what kind of supports do we need to find a common voice? And that I'll direct the first one to Juana.
Sure, thank you. Yeah. Well, I feel that there's different niches, and Andrea and I actually spoke about this a half hour prior to us coming up on this panel. And you know, what her and I had both said is that there's different niches in this market, and I think that if trade associations can find their own, you know, Andrea said, right, somebody needs to represent the growers, somebody needs to represent the patients, somebody needs to represent pretty much every facet of this industry. And if we can find common ground and unify and kind of have a resource for every single niche, I think that that's going to be a united front. That's going to give us the credibility that we need. We're basically saying, look, we don't need the government to overregulate us. We are responsible individuals, and we can regulate ourselves, and we can find common ground amongst ourselves and kind of find a specific area that each person can be responsible for. If there's somebody that's writing legislation, great. Somebody who's taking care of the patients, great. So I think that a unified front comes really starts with the trade associations and the different the number of trade associations. Some of them can amalgamate and become one and focus on a niche and give us a voice.
Andrew?
Yeah, those are all great points, and it was nice to be part of that earlier discussion because it definitely, is ongoing, and there's no doubt about that. But really, it starts person to person. It starts proprietor to proprietor. And when you look at the field in front of you and you stop seeing competition and you embrace collaboration, there's something powerful that comes from that and a transformation of perspective that really informs the community and keeps people united within our community and our sector. The union, as we call it. So, you know, it's all about supporting each other. It's celebrating each other's successes. It's acknowledging each other's failures and really working together to get that conversation evolving in a way that serves, first and foremost, our patients and our members. And second of all, our communities. And hopefully there's a part of it there that we also benefit from as proprietors and people who are in the community trying to create sustainable businesses. Because that matters. Small to mid-sized business is really the heart of communities. I've been across a number of places in this country and around the world, and people connect with their businesses in no way that you see in any other sector in the small to mid-sized realm. And when cannabis is a part of that equation and the healing and the wellness and the wholeness that comes from about that, it's pretty incredible. So just to stick together, support each other, and yeah.
Be a sure. unified front, exactly. Right?
Yeah, the unified front. David, you got anything to say about that?
I'm just going to bring it all back to cannabis and teens again, because everything pivots on this one point. Whenever they raid a dispensary, whenever they brutalize pot activists at rallies, whenever they go after anybody, they always justify it. Well, we're, you know, it'll warp the developing minds of young people. And if we all familiarize ourselves with the information that says it doesn't, and actually also act as advocates for teens who use it for stress and depression. The number one or two or three reason in North America teens die prematurely is suicide. Cannabis is an excellent antidepressant and relaxant, great medicine for teens. We have to become more brave. We have to learn this information. We have to destigmatize cannabis so it's sold similar to like coffee beans instead of thalidomide.
Right. Andrea, anything on that?
Well, one of the things that concerns me is that it's very easy to fragment as an industry. There are so many people who are very passionate about multiple issues that our industry faces. And like our political parties, we have three big major political parties, and we got Harper how many times because we both voted for the other guys. And we had a country that was run by, you know, somebody who was elected by maybe a third of our population. So I fear that with too many trade associations that we will end up with too many voices and not one unified voice. That said, I really do understand that people who, for instance, growers have unique needs and demands and retailers have different, and processors are different, and consumers have different. There are a lot of people to represent here. But if we can try to create a big umbrella that recognizes these core pillars and support that, that's, to me, the best way to move forward.
Awesome. Yeah. Great comment. So my third question here is, first of all, I just want to set this up. The Toronto raid that happened, 47 dispensaries raided. The police chief laid out all of the edibles and all of this stuff in front of the cameras, treating us like Mexican drug dealers or something. And, you know, and really, one of the main key points that he kept bringing up was that, well, we don't know what's in these things. These are dangerous items. We don't know the amounts of what's in them. And that was very important to him. And, you know, of course, that's a real issue. We are selling a product to the public. And my question is, what accountability do you think we as retailers of cannabis products have to those who consume products purchased in our shops? How can dispensaries become good neighbors and contributing members of the business community? And how do we, in you know that light, do that, start to regulate ourselves before the government overregulates us? And we'll start with Andrew.
Great. Thank you. Wow, that's a big question. It's not easy to meet, but I think it's definitely something we need to strive towards. I think, you know, you look at accountability, you look at your testing analytically and the insight that provides and the sexy science around what's happening in cannabis right now. I mean, it's not about these strain names, it's about this profile of cannabinoids and terpenes that has these synergistic properties within the endocannabinoid system, and being able to inform people about that and make informed choices around what strains and what solutions they look at is really, really important. So your testing is actually where all your conversational currency is built. I don't know what's in it until I test it. I don't know what the concentration levels are. I can't sit there and look at you as a patient and as a member with any sort of credibility or accountability or transparency and go, yeah, this is going to work for you. We don't know. There is no clinical testing going on at the level it needs to really provide the conviction and cogency we need to get communities perhaps to come on board more. But that's changing. And if we test, if we share that knowledge, But at the end of the day, if we don't interpret it in a way that the member understands, so you need sometimes colorful charts, you need to take time with people, you need to exchange ideas and information that are very personal, and you need to be able to respect that. So accountability is about consideration. And then again, that breeds into good business practices. And these trade associations that we're talking about, I mean, they're helping to lead the way in terms of providing a framework. I don't like throwing darts in the dark. I really don't. Give me a framework. I'll run with it. And I want to, and I like the idea of it, and it provides me the credibility I need to do what I do every day.
Awesome. David, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, when it comes to standards, you don't need to raid dispensaries to have clean weed. You just need to set up standards, criteria that growers have to meet. They have to test for contaminants and ratios of medicinal components in order to sell pot. They'll all get those tested. Now, the ELPs don't have to publish their testing. Supposedly, they all do testing. None of it's on any of their websites. The only tests that have ever been done to compare dispensary weed and LP weed came back in 2004, Canadians for Safe Access, and they found that the LP weed was higher in metals, higher in microbes, and lower in THC, and then they irradiated their weed to get rid of the microbes, but it actually also damaged the terpenes. We should not fear testing. We should just embrace it and have it above the board and require all the results to be published, and then we can really see if the LP weed is cleaner than the dispensary weed. I suspect it is, and I suspect the organic standards would take care of all of those concerns.
Great point. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly it. We as dispensaries are responsible for the product that we're bringing into our store. So if we do not accept product that's not being tested, if we do not accept product that's not properly labeled, if we don't take, you know, some guy coming off the street selling something that looks like hay, and we're like, oh yeah, sure, I'll take it anyways. If we create those standards, then we are responsible to our patients, and we also force the growers to hold themselves to a higher standard, because we basically suffocate that market where if your product is subpar, it will not reach our patients. And we need to do that, because that will take the wind out of the LPs, and that will basically allow for us to go to federal and provincial governments and say, hey, look, we regulate ourselves and we do a really good job, and here's our testing and here's what we've purchased and here's our labeling, and there is no harm, and there's not going to be any harm if you allow for us to continue to have this. And I think that every dispensary owner has that responsibility to their patients, and it's very, very important. With regards to being a good neighbor, you know, that comes to from your training and how your staff represents themselves. And I think that every single one of us wants to be a good neighbor and wants to be involved and included in the community, chit-chat, in the community flyers that they send out and the community meetings. And I feel like, you know, we need to take the first steps in introducing ourselves and putting ourselves out there, because we have been stigmatized and demonized, and those people are not going to come to us. We need to go to them. We need to change people's opinions about cannabis, and we need to do it in a professional and proper stand, and we need to have backing when we go to these people. Testing is the number one thing that we need to all abide by and ensure that products that are reaching our patients are being tested.
Andrea?
Yeah, I agree with many of the points that are being raised. I do personally feel a great sense of responsibility and to each of the people that I serve. So I think it's kind of important. The way that I came to it was from identifying the market that I felt that I could resonate with and that I wanted to serve, and then making sure that I take the time to provide the information that I know they need. So for instance, in my case, many people who come to the shop have never consumed cannabis, and so we need to have that conversation and talk about what's that going to feel like and what are your concerns. And I want to know that they've walked away with enough information to understand that this is going to be a little bit of trial and error, and you're going to need to find your place. And if you have discomfort, that's okay. You can talk about that. So the more information I have to share with, the better I feel. So testing, ingredients. Sugar-free, not sugar-free calories, all of that. It's all important.
Hmm. Well, when it comes to these regulations, David brought up a point a couple times now about youth and cannabis. Mm-hmm. And considering the you know, effective use of cannabis for young people. You know, we have even Sanjay Gupta on CNN highlighting that. But yet, of course, at the dispensaries, we still have our self-regulations that have 18 or 19 plus. Considering the evidence showing cannabis as an effective medicine, how do you guys think we should treat the use of cannabis by minors? How do we regulate that part of it? And I know what David's going to say, so we'll leave him till the end. Maybe Andrew or Juana, we'll start with you.
Start with me?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I think youth and cannabis needs to be treated on a, you know, one-by-one basis, right? There are youth that can benefit from cannabis. I think to stigmatize it and say that it's going to cause brain damage and this and that is ridiculous, because these youth are on prescription painkillers, they're on antidepressants, they're on a numerous amount of pharmaceutical drugs that have been proven to cause far more damage than cannabis. So I think to kind of have that closed-minded, you know, oh, well, it's an illegal drug and it must be horrible. Okay, what you're buying at the store with all the pesticides, that's probably harming your children way more than cannabis is. The pharmaceuticals that are being given to those kids to treat certain ailments that we know cannabis can help with, that's damaging your child's liver to an extent that is irreplaceable damage because they're young kids. So when we look at it, you know, we can't just think of it as cannabis. Should I give cannabis to my children? It should be, should I give cannabis to my children or pharmaceutical drugs? And that is a choice that a mom makes, not the government.
Right. Yeah, good call. Andrea?
That's interesting. I'm also a mom, having raised four children. The biggest consideration for me is that those are really, the years between 13 and 18 are really loaded. They're loaded with social issues. They're loaded with feeling uninspired and depressed and bored in school. They're under fluorescent lights for too many hours. They're eating lots of junk food. There's so many issues there. And while I'm definitely not going to say that I'm afraid that cannabis will somehow turn my child into a zombie, I just want to be really thoughtful about everything that goes into their bodies during these times. In particular, I had young women, so puberty was pretty dynamic. And for five females in the house, it was really interesting. So maybe cannabis would have helped, I don't know. So that, to me, I just want to be conscious. So yeah, would I choose cannabis over, you know, clomazepam? In a heartbeat. The whole, you know, using it for stress, I want to make sure that my kids have tools to manage stress, and if that happens to be one of the tools in the tool chest, okay. But I don't want it to be the tool. I need you to know how to take a walk, take a nap, read a book. And if cannabis is there, that's fine. So as long as it's a holistic approach, that's my personal opinion.
Awesome. Andrew?
Yeah, I just echo absolutely everything you said. As a new parent myself, it's a question I'm going to have to wrestle with. I hope to be proactive in that conversation and lead by example. I think that's really what it boils down to. When you take things to excess, problems arise. And when you are measured in your approach and you modulate your endocannabinoid system in a way that is responsive to your need and doesn't inebriate you to the point of ineffectiveness, then I think the people around you respond to that message. I do it every day. I microdose throughout the day and I don't apologize for it. I know exactly how much I need and why I need it, and I do that. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. I also use meditation and other approaches, but I suffer from PTSD. So that is something I really actually need to control anxiety and anger. And I think my family will respond to that and my children will respond to that. And I hope if I lead by example and be an effective community leader and liaison, we can move this message forward in a positive direction, but it is very much a case-by-case basis. So, and it's up to the mom. As a dad, I know that for sure. So, we'll see what mom has to say, that's for sure.
Okay.
Mom or dad.
Now, David, try to keep it. We're running out of time here.
I'll keep it brief. I realize that. But
yes.
In Washington State, they did it wrong. Teenagers are now facing felonies, whereas before they were facing misdemeanors. We have to be mature enough to say prohibition is going to harm our kids way more than marijuana abuse could ever harm their kids. Daniel Posse, 1992, young man, got caught with 15 grams in his own house, got killed in a police raid. All over the United States, around two or three every year, teens get killed in police raids over cannabis. If we find a way to incorporate them into legalization, we can protect them from the police, we can protect them from the black market, we can protect them from being under-medicated for their stress and depression, and we can keep them off the pills, which actually you can die from withdrawal from Effexor and other antidepressants, painkillers, ADHD drugs. I'll say one more thing. The Senate report recommended in 2002 that 16 years old would be the age limit for buying on your own. Now, that's acceptable to me if we have 15 and under with their parental and physician's supervision, 16 and over, buying it on their own. We are saying, as a society, with our own actions, this isn't as dangerous as alcohol or tobacco. And that's the right message to send to our kids, because they're not going to believe anything else, and they won't listen to anything else, because anything else is untrue.
Right. Yeah. I agree. Thanks, David. And David has written a book on the subject of youth and cannabis, actually. What's the title there, David?
The title is Free Online, Does Cannabis Inherently Harm Young People's Developing Minds? It's available for free online. And yeah, I've kind of ran out of copies. I was handing them out all day. But it's also, there's quotes from it in here. I still have some copies here if you want of my report to the Justice Minister.
Okay. Thanks, David. Now, just this last question here. We're getting a little low on time, and we're going to open it up to questions. But I just had one question here. As we move forward and recreational marijuana becomes legal on some level here, as the Prime Minister has promised to do, you know, this is, I think, an important step, is what do we do next, and how does this work with the medical marijuana dispensaries? My question is, can recreational use be considered medicinal use in some way, and how do you guys plan on handling the transition from medicinal use to legal recreational use? And Andrea, I'll start with you.
For me personally, I look at it, there's streams, there's medical cannabis, which, for myself, I would rather not have to meet, say, a young woman, single mother with stage 4 brain cancer coming to shop at the dispensary. That breaks my heart. I don't think she should be shopping in a dispensary. I think she should be in a place where she's cared for and someone is, you know, supporting her through the whole thing, and that should happen in a hospital. So maybe one day that will be the way that that happens. I personally feel that in my shop I talk a lot about therapeutic applications. So therapeutic may be around stress release. It may also be, you know, I need to make a painting and I can't use my brain. That's there. Some people might identify that as recreation. But the word about recreation kind of, to me, almost sounds like it carries a little bit of risk. So recreation would be like skydiving and cliff jumping. And so therapeutic feels a little bit more relatable to me. Yeah, I do think that there's a preventative aspect, definitely, about feeding our endogenous system, and I do feel that you can blur the lines between what is a really lovely day at the beach and was that not therapeutic for me, or, you know, yeah. So there I see a definite affinity between recreational, quote, and therapeutic medical.
Juana, next.
Okay, so I'm not going to touch on youth because I'm going to use the word choice a lot here. So for me, I think it's an easy transition. Listen, I think that whether you choose to use it for medicinal purposes or whether you choose to use it for therapeutical purposes, as long as we have the proper labeling, the proper testing, all of those tools are there and we've set ourselves up for success with regards to that, there really isn't much of a difference. I think that any dispensary can go either way. I think that it is a choice, and that's what it ultimately comes down to. If you're 19 years or older and you choose to use it because your back hurts, that's your choice. If you choose to use it because, you know what, at the end of the day, it takes the edge off and it makes you calm and it makes you not fight with your wife, that's your choice. And again, you know, the reason why we keep winning in the court system is because ultimately in Canada, you have rights. And when they're imposing or trying to take away your rights, you have a choice to fight back. So for me, recreational or medicinal, ultimately, it comes to the patient's rights, to the client's rights, the customer's rights. It is a choice. What you choose to use it for is none of the government's business, period.
Absolutely. David, you next?
Well, you know, as activist Steve Cubby always says, if you don't like marijuana, you're going to hate the future. Because it's going to be everywhere. When fully researched, it could replace up to 50% of all pharmaceutical drugs. And we have to look at the word recreation. It's not the antithesis of medicine, it's a subset of medicine. The word's etymology traces back to restore to health. That's what it means. And laughter has been called the best medicine. So we have to see all cannabis use as at least an attempt at preventive medicine, if not palliative, curative, other forms of medicine. I see a vision we can all unite under is what I call the organic fair trade coffee bean model with the 16-year-old age limit. I think that's acceptable to everybody who has an open mind and looks at the evidence. Cannabis and other herbs could be covered under the healthcare system so that poor people can have their herbs covered just as pills are currently today, and then we can take everybody off the drug war battlefield and legitimize everyone and get pot to the people who need it, and then we can all grow as a society and have good jobs with no boss and live in harmony with each other and our planet.
Yeah. I'm moving to your island. Where are we going?
And Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, in the interest of time, definitely I echo all of the comments up here. But really, it's a lifestyle choice for a lot of people, and they should have they have the constitutional right to choose. But we have to make informed decisions. We as proprietors and as a community have to be strict with our standards and rigorous with our accountability. But there is a therapeutic value to this that's undeniable. I get inspired by the words of Steve D'Angelo when he talks about these peripheral benefits because they matter and they're real, and that's, you know, where all the stigma and differentiation and everything is associated with in terms of people's minds and how they use. You shouldn't have to make that distinction, in my mind. If you want to use it therapeutically to relax or medicinally to treat your pain and inflammation, so be it. And as long as we're here providing quality assurance controls and information and evidence-based resources, then the conversation will change, and there's going to be a powerful, powerful movement across this country and across this globe. And whether it's therapeutic or medicinal, it won't matter because cannabis transcends all of that.
Fantastic. Thanks for the comments, guys. Great comments. Now, we are past our time here. I want to open it up for questions to the floor here. So I believe we have a microphone on, is it two sides we have microphones, or is it just the one now? There's definitely one here, so. Yes, sir.
Hi, this question's for David. The two things that Justin Trudeau says over and over again when he's talking about legislation in this next spring regarding marijuana is he wants to keep it out of the hands of criminals and young people. And do you have, looking into your crystal ball, have any idea what you think he is thinking about when he says young people? And to what degree keeping it out of their hands?
Well, I think he's playing to the ignorant. And when he means young people, they're going to pick some age between 18 and 25. And that's what they're going to say. And then it's up to us to challenge that. And when he says criminals, he just means poor people, because you know, rich people can afford LPs, right? The rest of us I don't have $5 to $10 million to start an LP. Most of us don't. So that's like 99% of the growers and dealers, poor people. So we have to start using the word young and using the word poor in describing the people we want to see also benefit from legalization, defend those demographics, and start, you know, putting it to them. Why are you against young people pulling them up by their own bootstraps and finding a good vocation in an emerging herbal healthcare industry? What do you got against getting people off welfare? I thought you cared about the poor people, and just making them feel really icky about all their life decisions.
Anybody else have a comment on that at all? You guys are okay? Gentlemen.
I mentioned this at this morning's workshop, but I think it's worth repeating. I don't know how many people noticed the recent article in CBC News that a political science professor, I believe at Carleton or the University of Ottawa, has advised Trudeau that extricating Canada from UN treaties on drug policies is a complicated process that would require years to effect successfully. The reality is that this is a flat-out lie. Article 46 of the 1961 UN Convention on illicit substances specifically stipulates that any treaty member can withdraw from the treaty by the simple procedure of notifying the UN in writing of its intention to do so. The last deadline for doing this, July 1st, has passed. The next one is January 1st. My concern is that Trudeau's intention, whether he has risen to where that analysis is completely false, that his intention may be to rely on that analysis to avoid or delay proceeding towards full legalization.
Comments, guys, on UN treaties?
Yeah, I studied this topic extensively. You're right, there's no penalty for withdrawal. You can ignore the treaties like Holland has been doing since 75. They actually have a principle called the expediency principle. It just works better this way, they say, and they've been ignoring the treaties. Uruguay's ignored the treaties. All the five U.S. states that have legalized recreationally have ignored the treaties. And everything that was medical since 1996, all the medical states in Canada and the U.S., that's all in violation of the treaties, too. There are arguably medical and scientific exemptions. You could drive a Mack truck filled with weed through. But yeah, these treaties mean nothing. And they mean nothing when they are weighed against the human rights treaties, the anti-genocide treaties, the anti-slavery treaties that we signed before these 1961 drug treaties. So yeah, the treaties are joked. Don't let anyone tell you that they're going to get in the way of anything. They never have in the past.
Awesome. Thanks, David. Awesome, guys. And a big round for our panelists, everybody. Thanks a lot, guys, for being here. We're out of time now, but that was really great. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
This panel discussion was recorded live at the Cannabis Hemp Conference by Cannabis Life Network. To read more about this podcast, hear other podcasts, or to watch a video version, please visit us at CannabisLifeNetwork.com or on social media at CannaLifeNet.
Introducing Jade Maple, only media and consulting company in Canada that utilizes seasoned experts in the cannabis industry. In a growing business environment, it can be hard to hold your ground. Like allies in battle, we help hold your fort from the city's regulations and legal uncertainties. Your energy goes into quality of product. Our energy goes into quality of image. How far do you want to go? Dispensary Solutions at jmaple.com.